Shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode and providing us with samples. In springtime, allergies can sometimes be my kryptonite. When my nose is plugged up and my eyes are watering, I feel like I struggle more to do the things I really enjoy. Making dinner, heading outside to get my sunlight before noon, and even hosting the show can be a bit more challenging. Luckily, for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. This double-action combination of prescription-strength allergy medication and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. I've been taking Claritin D for my allergies for several years, and it's been an absolute life changer. My eyes aren't a constant, itchy, drippy faucet, my nose isn't running, and I can speak without feeling like something has jumped in my throat. And I love that Claritin D tackles nasal congestion caused by allergies or cold, and also relieves sinus congestion and pressure due to allergies. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin Clear. Ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter. You don't even need a prescription. Use as directed. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Yay! All right, here we go. Welcome to the 1000 Hours Outside podcast. My name is Ginny Erich. I'm the founder of 1000 Hours Outside. And I'm so excited, thrilled to have Damus. Oh my goodness. I'm going to leave it in. To have David Thomas. How did I even mispronounce David? To have David Thomas here with us today. Welcome.
I am so happy to be with you. I'd answer to anything. I'm so glad to be a part of this conversation. So just know I'm thrilled you invited me. I'm such a fan of your work. So glad we're getting to have time together.
I feel the same way. A huge fan. The director of family counseling at Daystar Counseling Ministries in Nashville, Tennessee. The author or co-author of 10 books. We're going to be talking mainly about one of those today, but the best-selling Wild Things, The Art of Nurturing Boys. You speak across the country. You have a phenomenal podcast, which is how I found you, because we're always hanging out in the podcast charts together. The podcast is Raising Boys and Girls with Sissy Goff. I got an amazing opportunity to talk with Sissy. I've been working on my combat breathing or box breathing. So many things I got out of our conversation. And you live with your daughter and twin sons and a lab in Nashville. We have the same publisher for this one, Bethany House, and I'm with Baker. Raising Emotionally Strong Boys. I have to tell you, David, this is tools your son can build on for life. So I read a lot of books to talk to different authors, and I'm constantly sort of telling my husband about different things that I read, but only two times have I said, you need to buy your own copy of this one. And yours was one.
I am so honored.
It really is a life-changing read. These are the notes I put. I actually saw a lot of my own marital problems in the book. It's very direct. You know, you're with a lot of people, and so you know all of these different things. You're very direct. I had written, I don't even know what this is, like, going to sound so dramatic. I have written in here, more valuable than gold. I don't even know why I wrote that. That's a weird sounding. It's like out of the Bible. I don't know. I wish I would have read it years ago. And we bought a second copy. The only other book we've ever done that for is by Kim John Payne called How to Be Your Best When Your Kids Are at Your Worst. And I write in my books because I'm taking notes to get prepared for podcasts. And so I don't necessarily, you know, my hand off that one, it's all written in. And this one was so impactful. I was like, Josh, you need to read it. I mean, you have to get your own copy. And I just think for anyone that has sons or is impacting boys, what a book, David.
I can't tell you what that feedback means to me. And you need to know that I may need to come back to that more valuable than gold and ask you if I can put that on the back of the book for the next printing. That is so kind of you to say. Incredibly kind. Thank you.
Well, it really was one of those ones. It was eye-opening from the get-go immediately. I would love to start here. I thought this was really a sweet thread that ran throughout the book. The men in your life, your family tree. You talk about your grandfathers. You talk about your father. You talk about your father-in-law. And I thought it'd be a cool place to start because it's a reminder that this really matters. We are passing on a legacy. And we spend so much more of our time in life as adults than we do as kids. And so this is something to think about long term. So you talked so beautifully about your World War II grandfather, the one that was a builder, and you talked about your other grandfather. Let's start there. Let's talk about the legacy that we leave. So your World War II grandfather, you were the only boy in that lineage. Tell us.
It was a fascinating story in that my mom, so my grandfather who you're referring to, was one of five girls. And all of those girls had only girls except for my mom. So I was the only grandson. And as a result of that, it opened up the space for my grandfather and I to have this really unique relationship. And he was this beloved and respected builder in our hometown, and I went to work for him when I was in high school, and I learned a lot. I learned a lot about building, but I learned a lot about life and about myself through that process. And my grandfather and I laughed for years about his great hope was that he would hand over this building business to me at some point. Well, if you watch me with a hammer, you would have known early, like, that's not my calling, and that was never going to work out. But I remember having a conversation with him years into my work now as a therapist and saying to him, you know, Grant, I did become a builder. I think I'm a builder of men. And so I didn't become a builder in the way that you were, but I think I'm called to a different kind of building. But I think so often about what I learned through relationship with him, through, as you kindly mentioned, my other grandfather. I have a rock star of a dad, and it's not lost on me that I have had this exposure to these great men all throughout my growing up, which, to your great point, is something that I think is foundational that I really want for all kids. Just good exposure, where I talk so much about how kids in general, boys in particular, are primarily experiential learners. So they make their best connections by going through the motions. And when they can sit front row to these really amazing grownups who are doing our own work and figuring out, to my new book, how to name and navigate their own emotions, like, there is so much more opportunity for connecting the dots, so much good learning that happens when they can just go through the motions, go through life in those ways. So I'm incredibly grateful that, and still to date, I mean, here you and I are on a Thursday, and tonight, one of my kids are young adults now, is in town, and we'll go out to dinner with my dad. They have this rich, beautiful relationship with their grandfather that's outside of my relationship, which I love, that they spend quality time together even when I can't be present. And I'm thankful to have been able to pass down some of that legacy that was handed over to me, to my own children.
Mm. And you really think about it as a parent, because, and even if you were a teen, like if you had a teen boy that was reading this book, I think that would be motivating to them to know that someday there's going to be a son and a grandson, and you're going to say, this person taught me patience. This person taught me endurance. This person taught me bravery. And it also shows that we need a lot of pieces. We need a lot of people in our life, because you said, well, it was just so beautiful. You talked about your fishing grandpa, and you said, you still have the tackle box he gave me as a boy. It has my name on it and is the only thing I own with his handwriting. How powerful. I mean, that's really kind of a small thing. It's this tackle box, but all these pieces from all of these different people, they come together. With your own father, you wrote, I'm still learning from you, and I'm certain I always will. He was the best man in your wedding.
He was. He's the best man in my life. And so it felt appropriate that he would be the best man in my wedding.
Wow. And then your father-in-law taught me the value of engaging others and helping people feel seen and known. So I just loved this idea of really all the pieces that come together for our life, that we don't have to be everything, but that we can be very impactful in these certain ways that pass on a legacy generation to generation. This stuff is important. And one of the biggest pieces in this book, and it came up time and again, is that boys and men have this tendency toward laziness. And you say it over and over. They're lazy in their conversation. They don't want to think about what's going on. They want the summer to be chill. You know, I want a chill summer. It's just an incredible opportunity to talk to someone who has a front row seat to so many different lives. Has this always been the case? Where does this lazy piece come from? Has it always been the case, or is it something that's newer?
It's a great question. I would argue, I think, that there are some instincts that have always been in place that we're working against. Now, there's some new ingredients in the mix that I think feed and fuel that. And I'm super excited to get to talk more about that with you, because it's a part of why I'm so passionate about what you're doing and your message. But I would say, I think some of those things are both universal and have always been a part of the equation. And, you know, to even the great example you shared first of what I call emotional lazy responses, I just think we let boys off the hook a lot with, you know, how's your day? Fine. Anything interesting? No. You know, asking questions that tend to be answered in those ways, believing sometimes I think they're not capable of more, when I very much believe they are. They just have to develop some muscles that are less developed. And that takes work, as every one of us knows. And so I want boys to develop those skills that you and I both know in adulthood are foundational foundational to his own journey, foundational to every interpersonal relationship he's in. Like, you've got to have an ability to articulate your experience to be successful in marriage. You need to be able to communicate with your kids, to father. And so I want boys to be building these skills all along the way and what I call emotional strength.
Yes. And I like how direct it is, because sometimes we lightly skirt around the edges of some of these things. And you go through your statistics, and I think a lot of people are aware that men, boys, they are struggling yes. in these certain ways. I mean, it's one thing after another. Saying, I don't know, is easy and lazy. Most boys fall back on lazy responses, avoiding the work of resourcefulness. And you say it over and over again. I never let boys off the hook with, I don't know. It's a lazy emotional response and evidence of underdeveloped skills. So it gives the parent a little bit of permission to press in a little bit harder. And really, I don't know. I mean, this is, it maybe sounds a little harsh, but to me, it made me think, I mean, there could be a piece of lack of knowledge, but also I'm like, are we being lazy as parents? Like, you have this sentence, we spend a lot of energy pursuing our kids' happiness at the expense of their well-being. So to a parent who has a son that's sort of clammed up and is responding in these ways and not really taking on the responsibility for their emotions, what advice do you give them?
You know, I would say, I think two things come to mind when you ask that question. One is that I want us to see this as skill development, like develop skills, no different than kids have to learn to ride a bike or swim in the deep end of the pool. These are learned skills. And I would argue to the conversation you and I are sharing, harder skills to develop for a lot of boys where there are more instincts. You know, pediatricians would report at 16-month well visits that girls have on average about 100 words. Boys have about 30. So already her general vocabulary is going to be about three times his. So it makes sense that her emotional vocabulary would be more developed. So I definitely want to honor the fact that boys are going to have to work a little harder in this space to develop, but of such importance. And I would, you know, secondly say to that I loved you going back to my words of, we want to prioritize health over happiness. You know, I think to make boys happy would be to just kind of let them get by with this lazy response. To prioritize their well-being, their emotional well-being and relational well-being means, you know, I might say things when he throws out an emotionally lazy response, like, I don't know, to say, man, take your time. You got plenty of time. If we need to eat into some of your screen time, that's okay. Leveraging something that matters greatly to him for the sake of helping him build these muscles that he's not as interested in building. So I think it's okay in those spaces. And it's part of why I wanted to lay out a really clear roadmap and how to do that. Not just talk about how concerned I am, but what's a practical roadmap for getting there? Because I really love those famous words from Frederick Douglass, who said, it's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men. And I believe that 100% to be true. And we have this great opportunity in front of us to build strong kids. And that's why I wanted so much to write this book.
And one of your messages is, it's not too late, because we have a 15-year-old, and there was a story in there about a 16-year-old. And so one of the things you said is, it just might take a little bit longer. I thought that was very encouraging. Some phrases I've never heard before: build a psychological immune system. And I like this idea of looking at it as skill development. It's one of those things that I actually hadn't even really thought of. If a child says, I don't know, or they're just kind of not owning their different emotions. But you said, what if we looked at this, how we look at youth sports or how we look at their academic rigor, and we just don't. I mean, would you say, based on the people that you're coming, I feel like this in my own life, I've hardly thought about this stuff. Is that common?
I think it's super common. And I think we've got a culture that's feeding and fueling that. You know, we're greatly committed to and concerned about our kids' academic success and the amount of time and money that I think a lot of families spend making sure kids get an amazing ACT score so they can get into college, like all those different places. And my goodness, we could have a whole conversation about athletic success and the amount of time, energy, and expense we devote to youth sports. And hear me say clearly, I'm a huge advocate. I think there's so much good learning, but wonder what it would look like if we prioritized his emotional and social development in some of those same ways. Like, that's going to be the highest priority. I was with a great family yesterday, and they have a son who's really struggling with disrespect, and he's in pre-adolescence, and his mom and dad have decided, we're going to start leveraging his athletic experiences, communicating clearly, like, we're raising a great man first, a great athlete next, and those two will never be reversed. So I drive kids to practice who are respectful to their parents. And if that doesn't work for you, then may not work for me to drive you to practice today. So really thinking about how we could, again, leverage those things that matter for the sake of prioritizing the skill development, because I love that you highlighted the fact that it's never too late. I want any parent listening to hear me say that. In fact, I laughed with a mom I met in the airport recently. So I wrote a workbook to go along with raising emotionally strong boys that's called Strong and Smart. And I had 6 to 12-year-old boys in mind when I wrote that. And this mom stopped me and said, David, I bought Strong and Smart for my 7-year-old son, but honestly, I'm mostly using it with my 37-year-old husband. And I laughed in the middle of the airport with her and said, I love that. You know, I didn't have your 37-year-old husband in mind first when I wrote this, but I'm happy when it works for any male in your life, because as I said, it's never too late.
Well, I mean, that's what I said right off the bat. I was like, oh, this really helps me understand my marriage. Just sort of like a reactivity, that piece of it. And it gave me a little bit more motivation to work on these things. And you say as young, you work on it young. I mean, 6, that seems really young. It was 6 to 12. So start working on it young. I love when authors give verbiage, David, because I think so often we don't quite know how do you say it? So you just said it then. I drive kids to practice who are respectful. And you have this all throughout this book where you're talking about dropping the rope. Like there's so much tension often between parents and kids, and especially with screens now. And you say, you have the verbiage in here. I can tell you are struggling with my response. I'm here to support you, but not to be your punching bag. I love you too much to argue. We're done talking for now. I've given you an answer, but not the one you like. I'm going to head to my room and let you work it out. But this is good. Drop the rope. Like, stop this tug of war that we have with our kids. So the verbiage is so helpful. I feel like it's very rare that the actual words you say are in the book. In times when it is, sometimes I like write it up and I stick it up on my cupboard so I can remember how to say it. You said this prioritizing emotional health, the way that we prioritize youth sports or academics. And I thought this was just a funny part, so I'm throwing it in there. There was a sign up at some little league where it said, I'm just a kid. It's just a game. My coach is a volunteer. The officials are human. No college scholarships will be handed out today. It's great.
Isn't that incredible? I know. I loved when I came across that from a baseball league in California, actually, is where I found it. And I think it is that reminder for us adults, again, that kids are sitting front row watching the grownups they love the most in this world either do this work or not. And so they need to see us practicing regulation. They need to see us practicing expression. You know, we talked about the patterns with boys. I talk so much about how boys often get trapped between what I call suppression and eruption. So they're either holding things in, that's suppression, or they're erupting. It's exploding. It's volcanic, this emotion. And the healthy middle ground that we want to be targeting is expression, because otherwise, he'll just become more well-versed in suppression and eruption. He'll just swing between those two. I know a lot of adult men who are still doing that and you know, holding things in. There's a great line I put in the book that, you know, it's what we hold in that makes us ill, not what we express. And we tend to feel so overwhelmed by whatever it is we're experiencing. I can't name that. I can't say that. And I love the age-old words of Mr. Rogers, who said, if it's mentionable, it's manageable.
Well, that's good.
Aren't those incredible words? I know. If it's mentionable, it's manageable. If I can name it, I can tame it. If I can say it, I can work with that. And so learning to be able to name hard things that are happening, putting words to our experience, is what's so foundational. I was asked when the book first came out by someone, like, if you could give a Cliff Notes version of what emotional strength is, what would you say? And I said, you know, I think it's the ability to name and navigate our experience, which sounds so simple, but I would argue, according to the statistics that you reference, we're not getting there, because adult men lead the stats for infidelity, internet pornography, substance abuse, and suicide. And the common denominator with all four of those being, it's a male's attempt to numb out, again, suppress whatever it is that I'm feeling, shut it down, numb it out. And if I could move against that, again, if it's mentionable, it's manageable. If I can just name and navigate my experience, that's emotional strength right there.
Yes. And you have all sorts of strategies in this book. One of them in that vein is journaling. And when I think of journaling, I think of my dear diary with a little lock and key that was pink and fluffy that I had when I was in second grade. And I don't necessarily think of men, teen boys, when I think of journaling, but you say this is a way to get it out, right? To get it out there. I'm on a mission. This is a big deal, right? Like, I'm on a mission to help kids get outside. You're on a mission to bring back journaling.
Yes.
Why?
Where boys could record those thoughts. That's a tool for that middle ground of expression, is all it is. And I was one of those rare boys, I think, that did keep a journal. I had a notebook and I hid it in the back of my closet. And it was a place where I could write out different things that I was feeling or thinking or experiencing. And I've known so many boys over the years who've been open to adopting that practice, who've reported back to me, honestly, A, I didn't think it was going to help, and B, I didn't want to do it because it just felt like another writing assignment, that it actually felt good to get that stuff out. And I'm like, absolutely, because what we hold in, again, is what's hard. And so I believe in it for that reason. I believe in it for a second reason, too. You and I could have a whole podcast worth, probably a whole season of podcast worth about technology. And I would argue that I think screens and substances are maybe two of the things I'm the most scared about when it comes to the boys and adolescent males that we love, that I think are numbing strategies, the key numbing strategies that I see boys engaging. And one of the many concerns I have about screens is that, particularly when it comes to social media, is that I think social media is training us against regulation, not toward it. So, you know, I'm invited to post, tweet, whatever it is that I'm thinking in real time, put it out there for the whole world to hear. And I think that's incredibly damaging. We've certainly seen countless examples throughout the time of social media being in existence of where that's created great harm for a person. And I love journaling even for that purpose. Like, if you need to get it out there, the journal is where you should write that. Because my great guess would be that for many of us as adults, the things that I thought when I was 14 years old and in the eighth grade are not the same things I think now as an adult man. And I'm so thankful those things aren't out in the world, but they were simply recorded in my journal for me. And even maybe a week later, a month later, I might go back and think, I kind of feel different. That's how I felt in the moment when that breakup was happening.
Right.
And that was the place to record that. I share a great story of a father and son who had an exchange around his teenage son was texting his girlfriend's dad, who had grounded her, and it had gotten in the way of their plans. And he got in this text exchange with this dad in a emotionally charged moment, and he said all kinds of things that he wished he had never said that are now on his girlfriend's dad's phone forever and ever. And we had this whole conversation around what would it have been like if you had put those thoughts down in a journal for just you, and later you could have torn that page out and torn it up. But you've now said it. It's out there.
Mm-hmm.
It's out there. You can't take it back at this point. And so that's part of what I mean when I say I think it's training us away from regulation. And I think journaling is a great tool training us toward regulation.
This is stuff I've never thought about. It's this impulsivity. You have the thought, I can say it now. I can tweet it now. I can text it now.
Yes.
Whereas before, you maybe would have had to, you would have, I mean, even just to pick up the phone and it would have to ring. And then you would have to say, can I talk to my friend so-and-so? Like, there's a little bit of time and space. You talk about time and space in this book. This sentence, never thought about this. They are putting their first thoughts out into the world rather than working through thoughts and feelings in long form writing. So there's no reflection. It's just this immediate response, and it gets sent out because it can get sent out. Technology allows for immediate communication. We don't have to wait. Yeah, this is really good. This is a whole concept that I've never considered. And it also ties in with, there's a lot of middle of the night mess ups.
Yes.
You've got the front row seat. You're talking to the parents, you're talking to the teens. And if you're just your own family and your own household, you don't necessarily know maybe that this is a pervasive problem. What's going on in the middle of the night?
Oh, nothing good. Sleep should be the only thing going on in the middle of the night. And if we're awake, it's usually unproductive thinking. And it's where I put some stats in there where the majority of really awful texts come from, people who choose to send some form of communication. And, you know, the way I tend to think about it, Jenny, you and I are writers, and it's a little bit like a first draft. Like, every writer knows you never want your first draft out there in the world. Like, first draft is the worst draft. And I had to work over that and massage that and get other feedback on that. That's the other thing. It's like, we often will encourage parents to create a contract when they give their kids any form of technology, their first iPad, their first phone. And when they get first access to a platform, you know, we've talked to the parents about recommending, putting in the contract. Ask yourself, would you say this out loud to your grandparents?
Ooh, that's good.
Would you want this said back to you about you? So thinking about barometers that allow for those extra drafts, if we were to stay with this analogy a little bit longer, it's like, I never want my first draft out there. I'm so thankful that the book you've been so kindly speaking about, I don't even know what draft we're holding at this point, but I guarantee it was over a dozen because I had so many other eyes on that work that helped it develop into something different than my first thought, which is, again, what we are so often putting out there. And that's not what necessarily we'd want to be our final thought.
Mm-hmm. No phones in bedrooms.
No.
I've had countless parents report finding destructive texting, posting, and internet use in the middle of the night. Like I said, a very direct book coming from a man who has sat with thousands of families. And that's the person that you want to listen to, because things are changing quickly and it's hard to keep up with it. But if you have all of these data points, then read your book and you can tell people what's going on. Raising Emotionally Strong Boys, Tools Your Son Can Build On for Life. It's no secret. We love music in our household. And music lessons don't need to be expensive, boring, or stressful. Vogtberg Music Academy offers online lessons that siblings can share in the comfort of your own home. Instead of dragging kids to lessons and paying hundreds of dollars a month for one student, use my code OUTSIDE to get 50% off the first month when your children learns piano, fiddle, guitar, mandolin, or ukulele at VogtbergMusicAcademy.com. For only $15, get weekly lessons and practice principles, 24/7 access to your instructor, live student onboarding calls, and video vaults that provide dozens of extra lessons for students who want to progress faster. With Vogtberg Music Academy, you will never have to nag your children to practice as they work toward earning badges on their success path and performing for community student showcases. Once again, use my code OUTSIDE to give it a try. You get 50% off this month and give your children a lifelong love of music at VogtbergMusicAcademy.com. That's spelled VoetBerg MusicAcademy.com. And use code OUTSIDE when you sign up. Hair thinning is complicated. The problem is, it's actually much bigger than your hair alone. Like your skin, hair is a reflection of your health, and internal factors can impact the way your hair looks, feels, and grows. Nutrafol's whole body approach multi-targets underlying root causes like stress, hormone fluctuations, and nutrient gaps for visibly thicker, stronger hair. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement, with over 1 million people seeing thicker, stronger, faster growing hair with less shedding. While many supplements rely solely on ingredient studies, Nutrafol clinically tests final formulations to ensure their efficacy. In a clinical study, 86% of women reported improved hair growth after taking Nutrafol Women's Hair Growth Supplement for only 6 months. Take the first step to visibly thicker, healthier hair. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you go to Nutrafol.com and enter the promo code OUTSIDE. Find out why over 4,500 healthcare professionals and hairstylists recommend Nutrafol for healthier hair. Nutrafol.com is spelled Nutrafol.com. Promo code is OUTSIDE. That's Nutrafol.com. Promo code OUTSIDE. Let's talk about the physicality of boys, because this is very pertinent to this podcast. We are trying to get kids outside, especially boys when they're outside, and a lot of roughhousing, girls too, but you know, everyone's out there, they're moving. It's very physical. And all of a sudden, Jonathan Haidt says, we've moved from a play-based childhood to a phone-based childhood. 2010 to 2015 was the big switch. And here we are in this phone-based childhood. We have lost the physicality. How is that affecting our boys?
Oh, it's greatly affecting our boys. In fact, when I wrote my first book on boys, Wild Things, The Art of Nurturing Boys, I break boy development down into 5 stages. And in stage one, like right out of the gate, the first thing I say about boys is that he is active. Like, it's the first bullet point when I describe boys. And I talk about I do a little brain 101, and I talk about how the female brain secretes more serotonin, which is directly related to impulse control, and how little girls' frontal lobes grow earlier and are generally more active. And that's what allows her to think first and then act second. And boys tend to do the reverse. And I talk about all these realities that make him this active, moving creature, and how we cannot be thinking enough throughout his life about how we can create movement-based experiences for him. And I talk about it uniquely in this new book in terms of his emotional development. But one of the things that you mentioned that's so important, I think, that we talk about is that research would tell us that boys tend to have more physicality to their emotions. Now, there are plenty of girls that do as well, but it's why, you know, in a preschool classroom, preschool-age boys are a little more likely to bite, hit, kick, scream, throw. Teenage boys are a little more likely to punch holes in drywall. It's that need for release. And that need for release is not bad. What we do with that need could be good or bad. Right. So how can I take that emotion to something constructive? So I talk so much about in this new book how to help boys create what I call a top five list of healthy coping strategies. And I want the majority of those to be movement-based to honor that need for release. So it's been so fun over 25 years of doing this work to brainstorm that with boys and see what they come up with. You know, running, jumping on a trampoline, throwing a tennis ball against the garage, chasing my dog, taking the dog on a walk. I even had a teenage boy one time who had a unicycle, and he's like, David, riding the unicycle out in my driveway. And I'm like, that's awesome, because you're experiencing a release of some kind. And when we don't allow for that, that's when the eruption so often comes into play. And I have it happen every day in my office that I sit with parents who will say things like, he became physical. He threw something. He was screaming. Again, that intensity that's inside him needing to come out. And if we don't create a constructive path for that, I think it comes out sideways, often in destructive ways. So I'm just grateful you let me talk about it, because I feel so passionate about that.
Well, and this ladders back time and space.
Yes.
That we're not so reactive. And this includes journaling, or includes these physical ideas, to have this list of what, and everybody feels that. You just go for a quick 5-minute walk, it changes the whole thing, and you can come back more rational.
Totally.
Sissy talks about it too in her book. It's like the blood flow comes back. We're operating out of the wrong part of our brain. I want to read this sentence, because it's actually a paragraph, because it fits so well. Here it says, I believe most boys are capable of being their best selves when playing outdoors. Whether it's imaginative play, explorative play, or athletic play, when he's moving, exploring, and experiencing nature, it brings out the best in him. Then you say, and here's the big point, the opposite is true. The opposite is true. So you have boys that are coming in and saying, but when I play video games, I can also chill. They're going to try and convince you, right? They're trying to.
Oh, yes.
Do they try and convince you? Like, you've been doing this work for 25 years and they're going to come in and try and convince you? How does that go?
All the time. They try to convince me. No, David, wait. But I'm here to tell you, like, I really can calm myself down through playing video games. Now, what I will say to that first, what I'll give them is the acknowledgement that I do agree that it makes you stop thinking about whatever you're stressed about, whatever you're worried about. Because it's numbing. It's a distraction. And I talk about that reality. I say, you know, technology is for numbing, not for navigating. Back to that equation of naming and navigating. And so I'm okay. I want to be very clear in saying I'm okay with kids having a little bit of screen time with good, healthy limits and a lot of oversight, but not for the purpose of naming and navigating, not for the purpose of regulating. It's a numbing strategy. And so then I love to go into some of the science, you know, and just explain to boys, like, actually, it does the opposite. We've actually hooked kids up, hooked their brains up, and kind of watch the activity as you're gaming, engaging technology in those ways. And trust me, it does anything but calming you. Anything but calming you. I'm so thankful we got to have this conversation in this way.
Well, I've seen the statistics. I read it in Dr. Nicholas Carderis has a book called Ways 2. One of them is called Digital Madness, but the first one is called Glow Kids. And he was kind of talking about the screen time before anyone was really talking about it, and was actually like pushing back, like, no, this is fine. Everything's fine. And he said the gaming companies try and get your blood pressure up to something like 180 over 120 within 2 minutes, and you're sweating and a galvanic skin response. And if it doesn't do that, they go back to the drawing board. So to your point, you know, it might be a distraction, but it's certainly not bringing down our stress. It's not a coping strategy. And they're saying the same thing about scrolling through social media. And you write, the battles erupt over turning off a device. Everyone is saying this is the main parenting problem at this point, is dealing with technology in the phone. But you say you have limits and then go do things as a family that are physical and outside.
Yes.
Take hikes, ride bikes, canoe, kayak, climb, camp.
Yes.
Simply walk around the block. My favorite sentence in the book. Here we go. Are you ready for it? I've never been emotionally charged, taken a walk, and then felt worse. Never.
Never.
And have we ever been emotionally charged and scrolled on social media and felt worse? Often.
Absolutely. Do you see why I'm such a champion of your work?
It's a big deal. It solves a lot of modern day parenting problems.
Yes.
Which I didn't even realize it would, because we started getting outside when our kids were really little and now they're teens. It's been over a decade. And I'm like, oh, like we don't really have this problem or that problem too much because we're outside and a lot of these things are not issues. So a lot in this about video games, technology, but just more so about the benefit of physicality and getting outside. You talked about having, you call it the space. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. I love the idea of families creating some kind of space. And this is akin to the concept that a lot of schools use of like a calm down corner or a feelings fort, some place where kids could go when they need to do the work of regulation in the classroom space. So I'm working with a elementary school teacher right now, and she has a corner of her classroom and kids can go back there and they can, she has a big bucket of stress balls. And if they're about to take a time test and they feel anxious, they could get the stress balls. Or she keeps a mini trampoline. They could go back and kind of jump out some of their worry. If they've had a frustrating exchange with a peer at recess and then they've got to enter back into learning, they can engage some of these regulation strategies in that space in the classroom so that they can step back into learning and be present. And I love that idea for homes. And what if we were to create some space? Because here's the magic. I talk a lot about how where we put the space is not magical. You could put it in the corner of a rec room or a playroom or a mudroom or garage. What we put in the space is not magical. But leaving the emotional tug of war that you mentioned, I love that you mentioned that, and going to a space, that's where the magic happens. And kids are developing emotional resourcefulness in that way. Otherwise, they'll simply use us as their resources. That's where that tug of war happens. And I would argue bright kids in particular, really bright kids tend to often resist building this emotional strength, because these are kids who have these really strong cognitive muscles and they like to default back to manipulation, negotiation, a lot of different things that keep us as parents in that emotional tug of war back and forth, because it's like, if I can just wear my mom down and then convince her to give me a little more screen time, I don't have to do any of the work of naming and navigating.
Right.
Does that make sense? And so I really love this concept of the space that I think prepares kids so well for their own relationships in the future. You know, that if I have a hard conversation with my wife, we need to figure out when we need to take a pause and
yes,
both go do some regulating, come back together so we can have a more productive conversation. Yeah. So that's the idea, that we're training kids in that direction of what does it look like to pay attention to the signs and signals your body is giving you. That's the naming part. And then doing that work of regulation, which is the navigating, so that I can be who I want to be in these relationships.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm, again, seeing the world full of adults who sadly just have not developed these skills. I was in a coffee shop a few weeks ago, and I saw a woman being handed a cup of coffee, and she was walking toward the door, took a sip, and clearly her order was not what she had ordered. And that's a frustrating moment. And she turned around and started screaming at the barista. I mean, it was the most irrational response to an insignificant event. And you know, I see things like that happen all the time. I saw a mom in our waiting room recently yelling at our office manager because she didn't get an after-school appointment she thought she deserved. And what's so sad to me about both those examples, both the coffee shop and our waiting room, is that every time it happened, kids were present. And I think yes, kids are watching a lot of grownups in this world be dysregulated. In fact, I'm not trying to be political in what I'm about to say, but just an example of dysregulation. I remember being in elementary school and it was an assignment to watch the presidential debates. Like that was a required thing. And then we'd have to come back and do a writing assignment. I don't think that is likely a requirement anymore, because most educators would be concerned what kids might see if they watched a debate in this day and time. Like so many dysregulated grownups yelling, screaming, interrupting, name calling. It's like, when did we reach these places where it was harder and harder for kids to be able to sit front row and watch grownups in the world managing their emotions in the ways that I think are, again, so foundational to developing this emotional strength? So
yeah,
I'm so happy you would let me talk about this topic because clearly I feel so passionate about it.
I had this sentence bolded and all caps. Regulation is some of the most important emotional work we can do as adults to position ourselves to model and teach this to the kids we love. We can only take the kids we love as far as we've gone ourselves. It's big. It's big. So this book is really, it's for all of us. I mean, it's for me as a mom. It's called Raising Emotionally Strong Boys, but it really is a book that everyone should read because we are the ones that are modeling these things to our kids. One of the things that stuck out so much to me, and it's woven through your book and Sissy's book, which is Raising Worry-Free Girls. If I'm correct, that was the one I think we talked about.
You're correct. You're exactly on target.
These pair so well, Raising Emotionally Strong Boys, Raising Worry-Free Girls. And I like stopped me in my tracks. We're talking about the combat breathing and the box breathing. It's in your book too, a lot of that breath work. And it was something like in 90 seconds, you can turn the thing around, or it brings a lot of these feelings down and it brings the blood back. I was like, 90 seconds? It was but something so small. And I think that's a piece, one of the pieces that we're missing. Obviously, we're missing a lot. If kids are not experiencing analog, firsthand, embodied things, how are they supposed to pass that on to their kids? But, yes, you know, this piece of, you just experience it. If you go to your space, if you get out your unicycle, it might only take 8 minutes and you feel more rational and you feel more ready to do that. So I loved the idea in your book where you use your Apple Watch. I thought, well, this is brilliant about your heart rate. Can you tell people what you do?
I'd love to. Well, and I love that you talked a little bit about square and combat breathing. And Sissy has long called it square breathing in her office in her work primarily with girls. I have to dress it up a little bit more often to get boys to buy in. And so I call it combat breathing. And I learned that actually from some consulting work I did with Navy SEALs and Army Rangers, that it's a required skill for them to learn. Because back to everything you shared so wonderfully, that we've got to get our thinking brain back online. And when we can't, when our amygdala is flying the plane and the frontal lobes aren't active, there's no blood flow hovering in that space, we can't think rationally or manage our emotions. And so our objective becomes, how can I get that blood flow back to the frontal lobes? And we can do that effectively through square breathing or combat breathing. And to your great report, research would actually tell us at least 20 seconds, just 20 seconds, will begin to reset the amygdala.
Wow.
So that's just the beginning. If we double it to 40, twice the benefit, triple it to 60, three times the benefit, just one minute, go to 90, we're just knocking it out of the park at that point. And so what I'll do with kids is kind of explain, I love to talk with kids about how emotions impact the brain and body and how we have this God-given ability to, through something as simple as breathing, begin to regulate our heart rate. And I'll say, okay, I wear the Apple Watch. I want you to take a look. I got my heart rate right here on the front screen. Do you think it's going to go up or go down after you and I do a minute of breathing? And kids always know. They're like, I think it's going to go down. And I'm like, well, then let's test drive it. And sure enough, every time, 100% of the time,
wow,
I can lower it at least a point or two. And if I bump it to 90 seconds or 2 minutes, I can get it down multiple points. And they get to see that magic happen. Like something as simple as breathing begins that settling process. I talk a lot about how it's our job as humans to figure out, how do we get from stress to settled, from chaos to calm? And breathing and movement are the two most efficient, effective ways for any of us to get from stress to settled, chaos to calm.
This is brilliant. This is brilliant and something someone could do at any time. And even if you have a child that's older and has their own Apple Watch, then they can watch that. We had gotten a tool that measures lux, the amount of light. And just having those numbers was so helpful because you have to be exposed to a certain amount of light in order for your body systems to reset. Like we're supposed to have dark nights and bright days as humans. And if you get this tool that measures light, you see that indoors, it's like 500, 600. I mean, I'm in the brightest room of my house with the most windows, you know, it's 700. And then you step outside even and it's cloudy. We live in Michigan. Oh my goodness, it is cloudy here. It's like gray, but you know, it's like 4,000. And the kids see that, oh, this is actually a really big difference. And I have an understanding now of why I need to expose myself to these things so that I can feel better. Yes. So to have that right on your watch and to watch the numbers drop, that is so powerful and so easy.
So easy and can be done anywhere.
Yes.
If I'm sitting at my desk about to take a time test, if I'm sitting in a big room about to take the ACT, if I'm standing at the free throw line about to make an important shot in the fourth quarter of the game, I had a little boy tell me that after I taught him combat breathing. He was like, David, I was doing it on my leg, drawing the box and doing the breathing before the ref handed me the ball to settle myself because I had to make this important shot. It's so fun to teach these skills to kids and have them come back and tell us where they're test driving them and how they're working.
And that they have done it. They've tried it.
Yes.
Because then you take that with you for the rest of your life. You have that. You know, when you're asking a girl to dance, I mean, all of these things, we have interviews, so much of life is nerve-wracking.
Yes.
Where you're trying something new and you feel a little nervous. And it's a tool that you take with you forever that kids are trying and seeing that it works when they're children. That is a brilliant strategy. This book is filled with strategies like that. Strategies that you can implement now. You can take a walk and have a side-to-side conversation instead of an eye-to-eye one. So strategy after strategy, the no-yes response, the healthy mind platter, all sorts of things that people are going to find in this book, Raising Emotionally Strong Boys. You've heard me talk about how Element helps our seemingly always thirsty crew stay hydrated. Our kids have gone nuts over these stick packs. They love all the different flavors. We love them because they are zero sugar electrolyte drink mixes and they are super convenient for when we are on the go. Well, I'm super excited to introduce a brand new product, Element Sparkling. No sugar, no caffeine, all electrolytes. Element Sparkling delivers the same zero sugar electrolyte formulation you already know and trust, but now in a bold 16-ounce can of sparkling water. Become an active Element Insider to get access to Element Sparkling starting May 7th because they are publicly available. Element is trusted and used by everyone, from the Olympic weightlifting team, Stanford neuroscientists, and everyday families just like ours. Get your free sample pack with any drink mix purchase at drinklmnt.com/1000hours. And if you're an Element Insider, you have first access to Element Sparkling, a bold 16-ounce can of sparkling electrolyte water. That's drinklmnt.com/1000hours to get your free sample pack with your drink mix order.
When it comes to raising kids, there's so much to consider. Things like, what do we feed them? When do we feed them? How do they sleep? What does it look like to raise kind kids? How does their nervous system work? How do I keep myself calm? What are my triggers? There's so much that comes into play. And we are distilling all of that information for you at Voices of Your Village podcast, where we bring experts in the field of early childhood and education and psychology and across the board so that you don't have to comb the internet for information. You get to show up and hang out and have shame-free, judgment-free conversations and insights into what it looks like to raise kind, empathetic, emotionally intelligent humans. I'm Alyssa Blask Campbell. I have a master's degree in early childhood education. I'm a mom of two, and I am walking this journey right alongside you doing this work. Come hang out with me at Voices of Your Village, and we can dive into real conversations with actionable tips.
You also talk about friendships. And this is something, David, that I don't know, maybe if you're hearing about this more often, or if it's just a personal experience of mine, we're having a little harder time finding friends because there's just less of them out in the world.
Yes.
I think especially for our sons, it's just like, oh, everyone's playing video games at 10 o'clock. All of a sudden, it feels like the pool of people is less. And it's something that we are really kind of grappling with having teens and preteen boys. Can you talk about what should be the expectation of a parent in terms of how many friends are we looking for our boys to have and what types of friendships?
Well, I want to first say I share your concern in that space. I'm greatly concerned. And I'm hearing boys report that reality and parents report that reality daily in my work. And I want to say one thing about it before we talk about kind of what to do, what boys need in that space. The other concern that I carry, not only is the pool of friendship getting smaller, but I talk so much in Wild Things and this new book about how risk and adventure are hardwired into who we are as males. And another reason why I love the work you do so much and how much I think boys experience what I call healthy risk outdoors.
Sure.
And I believe that's foundational throughout development. And what I'm seeing, this pattern that I'm seeing, there's trending in this direction that I'm seeing fewer boys who are interested in trying out for a sports team or joining an extracurricular experience than ever before. I'm seeing, jump forward, fewer boys than ever who are interested in getting their driver's permit or driver's license. When I was growing up, I didn't know a single kid who wasn't chomping at the bit to get their driver's license. Again, healthy risk. Boys who are fearful about asking a girl to the homecoming dance, healthy risk. Boys who are fearful about applying to college. Like, our numbers around males who are applying to college, and I want to be clear in saying college is not the end-all be-all for every kid, but it is to say fewer males than ever are engaging the healthy risk of taking the ACT, applying to college, going to undergrad. And the common thread in all those being healthy risk.
Yes.
And if we keep diminishing those opportunities, boys are missing something foundational to their whole development.
And the screens, they're providing that.
Absolutely.
Or they're providing the illusion of it. And so that it's co-opting
yes.
the need for adventure, the need for risk, the need for deep stories that we all have, but especially our sons, and they want to adventure, and they're just adventuring through an avatar. And it's like hitting it kind of, but then I think it's an important thing to say that I've said this at different conferences I've spoken at, but I don't think we've talked about it on here. Like, this matters for the society as a whole.
Yes.
Like, I think so often we look at our lives as like, we're in this little box, we're in our little home, we're in our little family. Like, okay, well, if my kid plays video games a lot, like, oh, well, it doesn't really matter. But it is decreasing the amount of kids that are available to play in general.
Yes.
And I think it does matter. And I think sometimes if we look at it as like, it's harder work for the parent. It must be stated that it used to be the parent wasn't involved at all. The kids just went out. You shoved them out the door. Everybody else was out there. There was nothing to do inside anyway. So now it takes some work on the parents' part, but it's more than just your kid. It is affecting a community of people, and it will have a generational impact.
Yes.
If you do that little bit of extra work, that they go do the embodied experience, they join the thing,
yes.
they go to the park, it really matters.
It absolutely does. And it not only matters to everything we're talking about in terms of development and that need for healthy risk that's foundational to who they are and how they're hardwired, but it's to everything you're describing because they're not getting the actual practice of relationship. Research would tell us that 70 to 80% of all communication is nonverbal.
Wow.
So I've got to learn to read what your face and your body are saying as much as what your words are saying. And when boys have on a headset in the basement of a house and that's the only way of communication, they're missing that 70 to 80%. They're only hearing the words. They're not having those opportunities. And so it's foundational in terms of their social development. And to your great question on the front side, what I'm seeing happen is the intersection of those two things. I'm out in the world less, and I feel more overwhelmed when I am out in the world because I'm not developing these skills. So I want to be out in the world even less. And so it's this cyclical process where we're seeing he's just not getting these foundational things in terms of his emotional development, his social development, his whole development. But what I would say to your earlier question in summary to all that is that I don't think it is that boys need a pool of 35 relationships. You know, there are a lot of extroverted kids who want to know a lot of people and be in big situations. And there are a lot of introverted kids who are deeply satisfied with 1 to 2 meaningful relationships. So it's really not about the number. It's about the quality of relationships. And is he developing relationships where there's all kinds of practice, practice to work through conflict, practice to read the nonverbal, practice to develop reciprocity, which is one of the social milestones I talk about of the give and take. Like when I invite a friend over and we're interacting, I've got to do that thing where I've got to figure out, okay, what movie do you want to watch or what activity do you want to do next? Well, bummer. Right. I didn't really want to play flag football, but you're my guest. So we got to start where you want to start. Like all the skill development that happens in terms of their social development that is just so foundational to who they'll become as adults, that I love that you and I are having this part of the conversation because it feels so needed and necessary.
There's this woman, Angela Hanscom. She's an occupational pediatric, I said that backwards, a pediatric occupational therapist. She wrote one of my favorite books called Balanced and Barefoot about getting kids outside. And one of the things that she suggests is having all day, now play dates wasn't a thing that, you know, that's like a newer term, but all day, like go for the whole day so that you have times when you get bored, you have to eat meals together.
Yes.
Like it's too short and we spend 2 hours together. But that's something I was taught as a kid, that the guest decides, you know, you have a guest over, you're the host, let them pick and you can pick other times. So these are skills. They're skills that we teach our kids. You talk about how these kids are craving something they didn't even know they needed. And if you get to adulthood and you don't even know you need some of these key ingredients, I think you're going to be really stuck. You said, you know, you got to stop pulling people out of the river and figure out why are they falling in the first place?
Yes.
And this friendship piece, it's encouraging and also motivating because you say they don't need a ton. One or two good friends moving in the same direction is all that it takes. Also motivating because they can't get to adulthood and have never seen a solid relationship right. without posturing and all of those different pieces.
I have some questions on page 100 and page 107, if you're a parent listening and have a copy of the book, that I love asking boys about their relationships that help them think more deeply about the kinds of friends they want, what makes a great friend, how they can embody being a good friend. And so I really believe in the importance of, again, not just us talking about what friendship looks like, but I really want to challenge any dads who are listening that over the years, I have asked a lot of boys in my work, like, hey, who are some of your mom's closest friends? And with consistency, the highest percentage, not 100% of the time, but the highest percentage of the time, boys can name their mom's friends just like that. But if I flip the question and say, who are your dad's closest friends? Jenny, I can't tell you how often boys pause. Some can't name one. Some can't name beyond one. And I want to challenge any man listening. I think that's on us, guys. I think we don't always do a great job of modeling the importance of male friendships and how much, again, back to those scary stats, we learn in those situations that those were men who were isolated. Isolated with internet pornography, isolated with substance abuse, isolated with their thoughts before dying by suicide. And how could we model more of what it looks like for boys? So I challenge dads. I have a whole section on what I call narrate your experience. Like, come home and talk about it. Hey, I met my best friend for coffee this morning. He asked me two questions that really made me think. Can I tell you what they were? Like, speaking to what it looks like, what we're learning, how we're growing, how foundational that is to our well-being.
That made me emotional. Wow. Because these questions are so meaningful. Who supported you today and how? Who did you show up for today and how? And what if we have no one? You did talk about, you've had people in your office, their dad took their
yes.
life.
Yes,
and how
absolutely.
Unbelievably grieving and heartbreaking.
Absolutely.
That is.
I'm grieved to tell you that in the last month in our community in Nashville, it's happened three times that I know of. I know it's happened in times I haven't, but three that I've been aware of men in our community who've died by suicide, all of whom were fathers. And so their spouses and children who are in the wake of those losses, which is unbelievably complicated, layered grief in terms of taking steps forward. And so it's, again, just one more reminder why I think this feels of such importance and how I think we can't help boys think enough about friendships. And the thing I wanted to mention, too, as you were reading those questions is I hope folks notice that what I'm also doing in those questions is helping boys look outward. So we often ask that question, who's a good friend to you today? Which is not a bad question, but I want us to flip it. Who were you a good friend to? So that it's always inviting kids into that space of looking, I call it upward and outward. I have a whole chapter around that. And I cannot take full credit for that because one of my kids, all three of my kids are runners and they all ran cross country. Some of them ran track in school and one of them was running. My daughter was running at one point. I tell the story in the book and she was uphill, steep uphill during a practice. And she was like, Dad, we were all just drowning. And her coach turned the other direction, started running backwards and looked at the team and said, I want you to pick one person on the team right now who you can tell is really struggling and start cheering them on. And they later processed that experience and they're like, you know, it didn't take away the pain of running uphill, but it moved your thinking outward. You had a different purpose than just focusing on your pain, yourself, your discomfort. And it became about looking upward and outward. Like, how can I notice somebody else who's struggling? And it changes us. It changes us cognitively. It changes us emotionally. It changes us relationally when I'm looking upward and outward more often. Who are the people around me? It's part of that great I love that great classic saying of be kind. Everyone you know is fighting a hard battle. And it's like, who around you right now? It's a great question to ask kids. Who around you feel like is fighting a hard battle, going through something hard? What do you think that person needs? How could you be a friend to them? Coming up with concrete, practical ways that we could demonstrate friendship and show up for the people we care about.
It's so good. David, one of the best books I've read, like I've said, people listen to this podcast, they know I've read hundreds and hundreds. We have hundreds of books in our home from different authors that I've spoken to. Yours is one of two that we have double copies because I thought it was so imperative for my husband to read. Raising Emotionally Strong Boys, Tools Your Son Can Build On for Life. It's one that every family needs in their home. And if you're a teacher, that type of thing, you say you don't want pain to exceed resources. And this is what we're talking about with a lot of men, just a lot of people in general, that we have exceeded our capacity to deal with things. And we don't have the right tools in place. And your book gives those just such a valuable, valuable read. I got so much out of it. Things that I will take with me forever, forever. Skills. And we didn't even cover, I mean, there's so much more in there as well. Like we didn't even cover recognize, regulate, and repair. I mean, there's so much more in here. David, real quick, because we're at the end of our time, we always end our show with, oh, and I should say, you can find more. I'm forgetting all the important key ingredients here. Raisingboysandgirls.com, that you can find your podcast, which is phenomenal, top-ranked podcast, parenting, family and kids, events, courses. You guys are out in the community. You are, Sissy is. You're doing in-person events. People can come to those. So you offer so much. And also right at Daystar, if you're in the area, you can come for counseling. I've heard it's adorable, the picket fence, and there's a dog. So raisingboysandgirls.com, you can find more there. David, we always end our podcast with the same question. What's a favorite memory from your childhood that was outside?
What a great question. I would say a favorite memory from my childhood from outside. This is an overarching memory because it translated from summer to summer for me for all of my elementary years is we had a big field in our neighborhood and we would coordinate kickball tournaments throughout. That's going to kind of date me. I don't know that kickball is so much a sport anymore, but I hope it is. Out in this field, and I would forever be grateful that it consumed so much of my growing up and that it was kid-led. That's the other thing. Like there were not a lot of moms out there coordinating. We brought the snacks ourselves. We brought the cheerleading section ourselves. We brought the kickballs ourselves. We brought the bases. And it's like there was something so foundational to my growing up that happened in that field with those peers. And again, there's a lot of conflict resolution being practiced because we were also the referees and we'd have to work through if the play didn't go down the way the other team thought. And so there was all this opportunity for building independence, resourcefulness, most importantly, being outdoors, that I will always be grateful for. I really do. Just think about my elementary years and kickball is the first word that comes to mind. And it's where I hope if you hear me say nothing else today, you hear me say, it is why I've so long championed the work that you do. You and I are so like-minded and like-hearted, and you are doing such life-giving work in this world, Jay. I'm so honored you'd invite me to be a part of this conversation because I mean it. You are doing amazing work, and you are rescuing childhood for so many families by championing this message in the way that you are, that there could be a generation of kids who grow up in the same way that I just answered that question. Like it was foundational. It eclipsed my elementary years for those reasons. So thank you for the work you're doing that I would get a chance to intersect with you finally. I'm just so grateful.
David, that's so meaningful to me. I will cherish those words. And I love that your answer ties in with your book too, because we are heading into the summer and people will listen to this at all different times, but it's a spring and it's starting to get nice out and the flowers are blooming and we start to think towards summer. And you talk in the book, you know, you ask kids like, what kind of a summer do you want to have? And there's just this propensity, like you said, toward laziness, toward I want to have downtime. I want to play video games. I don't want to have any chores. But who remembers that? Who remembers that? Oh yeah, you know, I played this video game that summer in eighth grade. No, nobody remembers that. They remember the kickball. They remember those relationships and the fun and the camaraderie and the working through the rules and all of that. What an amazing answer ties into the book, Raising Emotionally Strong Boys. David, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Feel like you're the martyr in your family? You're not alone. Hey, this is Joanne.
And Brie.
And we're from the No Guilt Mom podcast. Brie, we talk to a lot of moms.
Yeah, we sure do.
And if you're a mom who has a to-do list that is so massive that you get overwhelmed and you shut down.
Or if you fall into the habit of doing everything for everyone and don't know how to change it, we can help you become a no-guilt mom.
We're going to take you from family martyr to family model. That's role model, so that you role model the behavior that you want to see out of your kids.
You're going to go from being tired and overwhelmed to energized and guilt-free.
Every week, you'll get actionable strategies that you can implement right away from the experts that we interview and from us.
We also have a whole lot of fun, so check out the No Guilt Mom podcast everywhere you listen to your favorite shows.